Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for joining me as we continue talking about the things that matter most. Coming up in the first hour, we sit down with Dr. Monica Miller and two women who were at the Red Rose Rescue in Flint, Michigan last Friday. They were both arrested there in solidarity with the unborn who were being executed. Patrice Woodworth and Lauren Handy will be joining me. I should also point out Dr. Miller's book, Abandoned, The Untold Story of the Abortion Wars, is a great first-person testimony of what she's seen over the last generation. All the various spokes on the pro-life wheel, educational, political, direct action, she's been involved with all of it. And this first-person testimony, I think, goes a long way towards helping us understand where we are today. So, again, I recommend it to you. This first hour, we'll be going over the Red Rose Rescue. Second hour of today's program, Ed Condon joins us once again, as promised, from Baltimore on day three of the USCCB's assembly. And they did sign three documents there, or voted on three documents today. We'll go over exactly what those documents were. Also in the second hour, I want to comment on some of the many comments made on Facebook page regarding my interview, except not my interview, my commentary on Marshall McCallum's interview with Jonathan Morse. Thank you very much, all of you who engaged that issue. I do want to make some comments, though. And also, coming up in the second hour, Dr. Gregory Popcheck. We've heard about the universal call to holiness. Well, as more and more people reflect on it, we begin asking about family spirituality, which is a major component of lay spirituality. Greg Popcheck is going to talk to us about how family is a vocation and also a path to holiness. But first, the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, June 13th. It's the Feast of St. Anthony of Padua. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is blaming Iran for attacks on tankers in the Gulf of Oman. NBC's Hans Nichols breaks down the secretary's address at the State Department.
He's clearly saying that it's Iranian forces, not proxy forces, that are responsible for these attacks that happened earlier this morning. That is a serious, grave charge.
Speaking at the State Department today, Pompeo said Iran's actions are a clear threat to international peace and security. He accused Iran of ratcheting up tensions in the volatile Middle East. Pompeo said Iran should engage in diplomacy, not terror, bloodshed, and extortion. President Trump's comment about possibly accepting dirt on a political opponent from a foreign source are raising concerns in Congress. Trump made the controversial remarks to ABC News. Terry Moore reports.
Trump said he may or may not alert the FBI about such foreign contacts and information. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer.
To say that it's okay for foreign countries to interfere in our elections? Disgraceful. Shocking.
Senator Lindsey Graham called Trump's answer a mistake.
The answer is no. It's got to be no. I mean, the likelihood of foreign interference is growing, not lessening.
The South Carolina Republican is a key Trump ally. On Capitol Hill, I'm Terry Moore, NBC News Radio.
Police in the Dominican Republic say the gunman who shot David Ortiz is in custody. In a press conference yesterday, the director of the Dominican National Police said the gunman was a part of a group that was offered about $8,000 to kill the baseball star. Ortiz was ambushed Sunday night at a bar in his hometown of Santo Domingo. He was flown back to Boston for medical treatment. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Last Friday, pro-lifers conducted a Red Rose Rescue at the Women's Center Abortion Clinic in Flint, Michigan. And to help us understand what is going on with these Red Rose Rescues and the thought behind it, the theology behind it, is Dr. Monica Miller, who you know very well as Director of Citizens for Pro-Life Society, the author of many books, including Abandoned, The Untold Story of the Abortion Wars. Also with me is Lauren Handy, a full-time missionary, founder of the Mercy Missions in a Catholic worker house. She also leads a prayer community in Louisiana, Gloria Dei. And also Patrice Woodworth, a mother, a pro-life activist, missionary, and teacher. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, it's great to be with you again, Al.
Yes,
thank you.
Thank you.
Monica, I'll start with you. For people who are unfamiliar with the concept, what is rescue and what is, in particular, the Red Rose Rescue?
Well, the pro-life rescue movement started way back in the 1970s. And so some people might be familiar with, if I mention something like Operation Rescue,
right,
and so on, where literally thousands of people, Catholics, a lot of evangelical Protestants teamed up together. And so there were, this was a national initiative of placing your body in front of the door, or in the hallway inside the abortion clinic, that the hallway that led to the abortion rooms, to prevent the killing of the unborn. It's a very complicated and a long story, and kind of a sad one too, I don't mind saying. Why in the basically in the mid 1990s, this very vigorous, essentially, you know, it was one of the major components of the pro-life movement itself, essentially died out. But in any case, it did for all intents and purposes. A couple of years ago, a bunch of us got together in St. Louis, in Illinois, to talk about resurrecting the rescue movement. But we wanted, you know, in our conversations, actually, I had had this idea literally for years.
Yeah.
And so now was my opportunity to launch it, okay? My thought was, first of all, there's now in place the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act. It's one of the reasons why the pro-life rescue movement died out. It's a federal law. Bill Clinton signed it in May of 1994. And so you get a federal charge, right, preventing ingress and egress to the abortion facility if you're blocking the doors.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, first of all, is it really necessary to block doors? Because in my experience, just the mere pro-life presence inside an abortion facility already stops the abortions. Moreover, when we really instead of just blocking doors and in a sense staging a completely legitimate protest, I mean,
sure,
don't get me wrong, that we try to make a real effort to reach out to the moms in the waiting room.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the 11th hour attempt, because within a matter of minutes, women are going to be walking down a hallway and going into one of these abortion chambers, and their babies are going to be executed. Death and killing is going to happen. And if we go in and we pretty much have a rule, you know, not necessarily hard and fast, but we have a rule. We're not going to, we'll not have more than six people going in, because we're not doing a protest,
right,
of abortion.
Right.
So we don't want to make it look like we're glutting, you
mm-hmm.
know, the waiting room with a bunch of protesters in order to create a disturbance. What we really want to do is quietly and being as incognito as we can under the circumstances, go in, sit down next to the moms that are already assembled, waiting for their abortions, filling out paperwork, whatever, they're waiting for the abortionist to get there. Talk to them, offer them help, give them pro-life literature, and and encourage them to leave with us. And so, you know, if a mother makes the decision to get up and leave the clinic, then one of the rescuers will go with her.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not, that rescuer is not going to stay in the clinic anymore. We've accomplished our goal.
Right. Well, there are people listening who would think that that's utterly implausible, that somebody would just get up and they're there for an abortion.
Yep.
And the pro-lifer talks to them and then they get up and leave.
It's happened.
Yeah, I know.
Maybe Patrice could talk about that very scenario,
okay,
and that rescue that we did in West Bloomfield.
Mm-hmm.
But the other aspect to the Red Rose Rescue, in addition to really wanting to engage the mothers in those final moments, this is the last opportunity that the women scheduled for abortions are ever going to have to turn away. We want to give them that opportunity.
Right. And the Red Rose.
And eventually during the time that we're in the abortion clinic, we will hand out the roses. We don't hand them out right away, because once we do that, we've kind of, in a sense, blown our cover. I mean, we don't want to alert the staff, and we want to blend in as much as we possibly can for how many minutes that we can. So we don't bring those roses out until the very end. But the other, here's our philosophy about why we don't leave. Okay. And it's most likely, you know, we've done 14 Red Rose Rescues now since September 15th of 2017. So our second anniversary is coming up in September.
Wow.
And so our experience is, of course, that the vast majority of the moms are not going to leave with us or go out of the clinic. The babies who are scheduled for slaughter, our philosophy is that they deserve, as fellow members of the human race who are unwanted, outcasts, abandoned by their own parents, that they deserve to have somebody stay with them.
Mm-hmm.
And for as long as we can stay with them. So we are in solidarity with the unwanted. And we will stay in that clinic. And as long as we're there, they are protected. The abortions are stopped. They are halted. The killing process is halted by our presence.
So your very presence there is an expression of solidarity with the unborn.
And so we stand in solidarity with the unwanted of the human family. And so if the police are called and they order us to leave, we have to tell them we can't go.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to stay with these babies. And so we have to be taken away.
So what legal consequences follow?
The possibility of an arrest is, of course, there.
Mm-hmm.
I may mention, by the way, this has been a very interesting experience in the 14 Red Rose Rescues that we've had so far, it's been an amazing experience going through the legal system, because our experience has ranged from zero charges,
right,
absolutely zero charges, to of course what we faced here in Michigan, in particular in Oakland County, where, you know, we basically got the books
right.
You know, thrown
last
at us.
So, summer, you were in
yeah,
jail.
Yeah, and then last year we did a short jail, a sentence at Oakland, mm-hmm, County Jail. That was because we refused to obey the probation conditions,
right,
in conscience. We told the judge we couldn't obey the bail the probation conditions that were imposed on us. Literally, in the history of a legalized abortion, that judge, Judge Barron, Mark Barron, of the 48th District Court there in Oakland County, I don't know, we said, well, what do you think you are, the king of the world? He ordered, as part of our probation, that we had to stay 500 feet away from every abortion clinic in the United States of America, including her territories. and I said, you know, and with all due respect, Judge Barron, there's no way we can abide by that. And so we violated it. That's why we, you know, we're not good candidates for probation.
Right.
So we did the jail sentence. But in any case, staying with those unwanted is, I think, an essential part of what we do as pro-lifers, to be with, and I, as I characterize our work, Saint Mother Teresa of Calcutta had that vision of why she left her Sisters of Loreto to found her own Missionaries of Charity.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because she said, I don't want the poor to come to us. Mm-hmm. I want to go to them.
Right.
Amen.
And so she said, what I want to do is I want to go into the dark holes of the poor. I want to go into their lives, into the dark. And she really literally meant their little dark hovels.
Right.
You know,
right.
these tin shacks, cardboard boxes, whatever, right. that these people, the poorest of the poor in India, to actually go into those dark holes mm-hmm. and be with the poor. And so, in the United States of America, I think an abortion clinic qualifies as one of those very dark holes.
Yeah.
The place of despair, the place of hopelessness, desperation, and murder. And
this
so we go. We go into the dark holes of the poor to be with the poor. And the poorest of the poor, according to even Saint Mother Teresa, is an unwanted, unborn baby.
And this is, in imitation of the Incarnation, where God takes the initiative
right.
and meets us wherever we are.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah, so that's what's going on.
The Word became flesh and dwelt among us.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? Dwelling among us means dwelling with us poor sinners.
Yeah.
You know, sharing our experience, staying with us to save us, to defend us. And that's what we want to do as Red Rose Rescuer.
Well, we need to take a break. Let me go to Patrice next, and I'll ask the question now. And when we return from the break, I'll re-ask it to you, Patrice. I asked Monica earlier about many people and how they would think that women seeking abortion, they've showed up already. How are they going to change their minds simply because a pro-life worker shows up, you know, and strikes up a conversation with them? I mean, look, she's already considered abortion. She thinks it's the least of the three possible evils, motherhood, abortion, or adoption. And so are you saying that women actually change their mind, turn around, leave the killing floor, take up talking with rescuers or sidewalk counselors, and then deciding that they're no longer abortion-minded? Does that actually happen? So hold it there. That's the question. We'll be back on the other side of the break. I'm talking with Dr. Monica Miller, Patrice Woodworth, and Lauren Handy, all three participated in last week's Red Rose Rescue in Flint, Michigan. Four of the rescuers were arrested when they opted to stay in the abortion center in solidarity with the unborn who were scheduled for execution. Both Patrice and Lauren were arrested, and Dr. Miller of Citizens for Pro-Life Society has been one of the organizers of these rescues. I'm Al Cresta.
Bishop Robert Barron on the priesthood.
I've been a priest for 31 years. It's a call to a total gift to Christ. It's a total gift of one's life to be conformed to Christ. You know, and that's why I felt it when I was a young guy and I was kind of getting into religion and understanding it more deeply intellectually. It just began to hit me with a great clarity that if this is true, if God is real and God is a supreme good, well, why wouldn't I give my whole self to God? Why would I get distracted by anything else, you know? Now, again, I'm not saying that should be true for every single person on the planet. That's the way it hit me when I was a young guy, was I want to give as much as I can, my whole self, to Christ. So there's something heroic about that, where you do eschew a lot of things. You say no to a lot of things so you can say massively yes to Christ and to his demand. I think that's a heroic quality of it.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Why are there so few practicing Catholics in public office? And by practicing, I mean Orthodox, faithful to all the Church's teachings. There are many thousands of good Catholic candidates for school boards, mayor seats, state senate, Congress, governorships, even the presidency. They're out there. Some of them may be listening right now. We need to spend less time complaining about faux Catholics out there and more of our time encouraging the real ones to get in the game. In the Catechism of the Catholic Church, number 1915, we read, as far as possible, citizens should take an active part in public life. Don't get me wrong, public life is not easy. The times are tough. But were they as tough as the first, say, 300 years of the Church? Haven't we as Catholics faced down more fearsome enemies than the ones we face today? I think so, too. I'm Patrick Coffin of PatrickCoffin.media. Be a saint. What else is there?
Started drinking beer on Saturday nights, sleeping in on Sunday mornings, missing Mass, and it just became a pattern and continued. Without God, I don't know where I'd be right now. I know the importance of the Eucharist. I know the importance of the sacraments that I didn't know at a young age. I follow God's will because my desire is to get to heaven. Our lives are rich and full by being members of the church.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. I want to announce that Steve Ray and I will be going on pilgrimage to the great land of Poland, August 21st to August 30th.
We're going to follow John Paul II, Maria Faustina and the Divine Mercy, and Maximilian Kolbe. We're even going to visit Auschwitz and see the place where Maximilian Kolbe gave his life in the cell there.
People can get more information at AveMariaRadio.net. And where else, Steve?
CatholicConvert.com. Click on the big pilgrimage banner or call 866-468-1420.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Imagine 4 days of learning from and conversing with some of the Western world's leading thinkers, organizers, activists, and entrepreneurs. I'll be there at Acton University June 18th to 21st in Grand Rapids, Michigan, along with family scholars like Brad Berzer and Ryan Anderson, biblical thinkers like Scott Hahn, social critics like Father Robert Sirico, Jay Richards, Jennifer Roback Morse, and dozens more teachers and hundreds of learners like you. Learn more at university.acton.org.
Beth, why is our health insurance so expensive? Our premium and deductible are so high. Plus, I don't want my family to support a company that doesn't share our values.
Kim, there is another option. Check out CMF Curo. It's an affordable Catholic healthcare ministry where members share their medical costs in community, and it's pro-life. We joined last year and have saved thousands, all without compromising our values. Just go to MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
CMF Curo sounds exactly like what our family needs.
Yeah, that's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. I'm speaking with Dr. Monica Miller, who organized last week's Flint, Michigan Red Rose Rescue. Also with me, Lauren Handy and Patrice Woodward, both of whom were arrested when they refused to leave the reception area of the abortion clinic. So let me go to Patrice here.
Yes.
So I asked Monica earlier about, I think many people would think it's highly unlikely that women seeking abortion who have already shown up at the clinic there are going to change their mind because of a pro-life worker sitting in the clinic entrance reception area and talking with them. Has it happened?
Well, we did experience that. A woman did leave. Mm-hmm. When we were at West Bloomfield Clinic last year in Oakland County, and a woman that I was blessed to talk with, and I spoke with her and just told her how beautiful she was and that her baby was going to look like her and God didn't want her to kill her baby.
Yeah.
And then shortly after, about 4 minutes after, they herded them like cattle into the back room, which for the demographics of the place was highly ironic. Because they were supposed to be very intelligent women, and women don't allow themselves to get herded into,
yeah.
So about 4 minutes later, she walked out of that room and left and exited the building. Mm-hmm. And that was all we knew.
Well, except for one thing. We have legal corroboration that woman, at least that day. No, actually, I want to say she didn't come back.
Yeah.
How do we know that? Right? Because of the 12 women.
7 months later, we were taken to court because they wanted to sue us for the money they couldn't make killing babies while we were there.
Okay.
So it's called restitution.
Yeah, the restitution right.
But I call it suing us for. And so anyway, we had 12 out of 23 women, we find out, because Pamela DiMaggio got up and she testified in court with the script of people, numbered them off. 12 out of 23 women didn't show up, and that was 53%.
And one of them was the woman coercion. That left.
That left, okay.
Yes.
Lauren, you were going to want to say something there.
So part of the Red Rose Rescue is a strong outside support team as well.
Yep.
In the D.C. rescues and in the Virginia rescues, we found that when we have pro-lifers on the inside, the cops will shut down the whole surrounding area. So women who are trying to go into the abortion facility, they don't go in actually at all. So that gives a greater opportunity for sidewalk counseling, a lot of turnarounds and babies saved within the context of the DC Red Rose rescues were because of our outside support team. At the rescue, one of the rescues at Stephen Brigham's abortion facility in DC, there was a woman who was herded into the back, but through the crack of the door, I continued to talk with her. She left and mm-hmm. she didn't come back. She okay. said she couldn't do it. And so her and her father left. And then she went downstairs to the outside support team.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of parts to this to where right. there can be many opportunities for saves.
So it's not just happening in the reception area. You've got people on the outside as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are you able to bring an ultrasound machine with you?
No, we haven't been able yeah. to do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to, you just don't buy one at the local CVS.
You're right. If if there was the opportunity to take the moms to a mobile unit,
right.
but so far that has not been the case.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the response of police. And if it's anything like the way police responded back during the days of Operation Rescue, each department responds a little differently.
Mm.
And what has been the response from the various police departments that you've had to deal with?
I find that the police, first of all, they don't want to arrest you. Mm. And I can't say that this has been the case in all the 14 right rescues that we've had so far, but a lot of times they give you, you know, a lot of opportunity to leave the clinic.
Right.
They give you multiple warnings, but there's going to come a point where they see that we are very, you know, that we're not going to go. Now, the rescue that happened this past Friday in Flint, Michigan, I was pretty surprised at the delay. I think that rescue from beginning to end lasted almost a full 90 minutes. And the police had arrived probably within a good half an hour into the mm-hmm. rescue.
Mm-hmm.
Have I got that right, pretty much? Okay. Mm-hmm. And so then you've got a whole nother hour, or what are they doing? You know, talking, negotiating, looking up state statutes, conversing with the clinic staff.
Right.
Until finally, you know, there comes a moment where they have to face the fact that the rescuers are not leaving on their own power.
Yeah, that you've broken their law.
Yeah, and so the arrests will be, you know, the rescuers practice passive resistance, meaning they just lay down on the floor, will just sit and will have to be carried out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not a hard and fast rule for us, because if we have a rescuer who's got a medical issue and doesn't want to risk, you know, being hurt in some way, people are free, our rescuers are free to walk out if that's what they feel they need to do. But ideally, we don't want to be walking out on our own. We have to be taken away.
Mm-hmm. What do you say to people who think, well, Christians should not break the law like this?
I would say that we're not breaking a Christian law. This law is an unjust law, and therefore it is not a law at all. We believe that there is life in the womb,
mm-hmm.
and when there's life in the womb, that life deserves to be protected, and therefore we have a right to go in and defend
mm-hmm.
that life. We
mm-hmm.
have a right to defend that life, a right to be there defending that life. If there was we get hit with trespass and other things, but if there was a child drowning inside a pool that had a no trespassing sign on the gate, would you not jump the gate if that
right.
child was drowning?
Right.
Or would you? I'd hurdle that thing really fast and go save that child. So that's the idea here.
Here. In the past, pro-lifers have tried to use the necessity defense because
yes.
they use that illustration.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's in play as I speak.
Yeah, okay.
By the way, I must mention our fantastic attorneys. Robert Muse
yeah.
from Thank the American Freedom Law Center has once again stepped forward to defend the four the four rescuers from Friday's rescue. He will be assisted by another attorney named Jody Quisenberry, and we are incredibly grateful. But we've had Alliance Defending Freedom attorneys helping us, the American Catholic Lawyers Association with Chris Ferreira helping us. The attorneys are fantastic. And again, Robert Muse, I just can't tell you how grateful I am to that man.
Yeah. Well, he's doing tremendous
work. But we have two
work.
Cases I should mention from our Sterling Heights rescue that we did in Michigan at the Northland Family Planning Abortion Center. Yes, we were convicted because we were denied that defense of necessity.
Yeah.
This is a very interesting and complicated story, by the way, why we can't have that defense. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then again, in the rescue that we did in West Bloomfield at the Jacob Kahlo, he's the abortionist, his Women's Center abortion clinic, where the 12 women didn't show up that day for their abortions because of our rescue. But those cases are right now sitting in front of the Michigan Supreme Court. And Robert Muse is the lead counsel for that. So if people want to say some serious, serious prayers that the Michigan Supreme Court will accept our petition for a hearing and that justice will be done for the babies. Because that's what this is about, justice for them.
Laura?
And if we go back into the rich history of our Catholic faith and even into the catechism, it states that we do not have to follow man's law when it contradicts God's law. I mean, we've seen a rescue in the sense of all the way back to the early Christians when they would take the babies that were being left out from the at the exposure walls all the way to our Christian brothers and sisters hiding Jews in Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm.
When the government does not have the authority to make it a right to kill. Because and even though it has the power to punish us, and so to understand that is to gives us I guess the go ahead and good conscience to be able to go inside the abortion facility, even though in the eyes of society we are breaking man's law.
Now explain, somebody give me a story of. You mentioned one already, Patrice, about approaching a particular woman. I think listeners are intrigued by this. I mean, exactly what do you say? You know, how do you start the conversation? Who wants to take it up?
Well, let me start. You go in and literally you're walking in just like anybody else. Okay, you're not storming the parapets. Okay, you're
right.
You know,
this is prayerful and peaceful.
But you're going in, you walk in, and you hopefully you find a chair that's next to a mom that's sitting there, and you simply very quietly say, "I'm here to help you, so that you won't get this abortion today. I have the ability to help you financially, and you know that this is your beautiful son, your beautiful daughter, and you don't have to do this. Here's some phone numbers you can even call the local crisis. Would you come out with us?" And I'll introduce myself. I say, "I'm Monica."
Yeah.
What's your name? For example, in the first rescue that we did at the Northland Family Planning Clinic in Sterling Heights, that I won't give her name out, but I sat down next to the mom, and I told her my name, and I asked her for hers. She told me her name,
mm-hmm.
and I said, "Will you come out with me? Let's go." She stood up and was about to walk out, but unfortunately, the abortion clinic worker came in between us and ushered her away, and she had the rose.
She already had the rose. Wow.
I think if it had not been for the interference on the part of the abortion clinic worker, that woman would have left with me.
Yes, I mean, so often women are ambivalent about receiving an abortion. A survey that was done it's a few years ago now, but it saw that women with unplanned pregnancies, unexpected pregnancies, saw their pregnancy as having three possible outcomes, all of which were considered various forms of evil. Motherhood was considered an evil. adoption was considered actually the worst outcome, and abortion was considered the least of the three evils. We're going to continue conversation with Dr. Monica Miller, who organized last week's Flint, Michigan Red Rose Rescue. We're also going to be talking with Lauren Handy and Patrice Woodworth, discussing their participation. We'll be right back. I'm Al Cresta. Join me, Teresa Tomeo, and Father John Ricardo for fun fellowship and beautiful weather during our Good News Marriage Cruise. Former NFL star Matt Burke will also be there sailing the Caribbean as we explore how to rejuvenate your marriage in Christ. We're sailing January 26th to February 1st, so call 855-879-6932. That's 855-879-6932. Or visit AveMariaRadio.net for early registration discounts.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. St. John Paul II stated that for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love, and the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation. So we know we're called, but how do we do it? St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Underwritten in part by this not-for-profit.
Have you heard about Lord Teach Me to Pray? Lord Teach Me to Pray is a prayer series based upon the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius of Loyola.
Training retreats will be held this summer and fall in various parts of the country. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com to find a training retreat near you. In this exciting time of the new evangelization, the best way we can share the faith is by strengthening our own relationship with the Lord Jesus.
Lord Teach Me to Pray is sure to be transformative.
Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com and click on Facilitator Training Retreats.
Now, on the Ave Maria Radio app, the prayer section, where you can listen to the Holy Rosary. All four mysteries are voiced by Christ as the Answer and Father Knows Best host, Father John Ricardo. Are you struggling to remember specific prayers for pre- and post-confession, reciting the Stations of the Cross, or prayers during Eucharistic adoration? It's all there, word for word, and within a few clicks under the prayer section on the Ave Maria Radio app. Download it on your smart device today.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are committed.
As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
We recently prevailed in a lawsuit filed in an Oklahoma federal court by Raja E. Fatia, a Muslim and a board member of CARE Oklahoma, against Chad and Nicole Neal, the owners of an Oklahoma gun range. Fatia was represented by lawyers from CARE, the ACLU, and a large New York law firm, the usual suspects. The American Freedom Law Center represented the Neals. The controversy arose when in 2015, Fatia entered the Neal's gun range armed with a loaded military-issue handgun strapped to his side, a military-style rifle slung over his shoulder, magazines loaded with approximately 140 rounds of 9mm ammunition, a concealed recording device in his pocket, and a dangerous agenda. To create a controversy with armed individuals at the gun range, hoping that he would not be allowed to fire his weapons so he could file this meritless lawsuit and run to the media with his prearranged Islamophobia narrative, knowing that the liberal media would willingly serve as an echo chamber for his spurious claim of discrimination. CARE's lawsuit was dismissed with prejudice. CARE's extremely reckless and dangerous attempt to set up a lawsuit to make a political point has failed. Apparently, CARE and the ACLU didn't want to put CARE's nefarious ties to terrorism on trial, so they caved in. And in the end, the good guys won yet again. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. We're discussing last week's Red Rose Rescue in Flint, Michigan, with Patrice Woodworth, Lauren Handy, both of whom were arrested at the Flint abortion mill, And Dr. Monica Miller also is with me, one of the organizers of these rescues. Now, what's the response? You introduce yourself, they become clear why you're there, right? I mean, that's one of the first things you get across to them. What's the normal response? How do they, because they went there not imagining
that
there was going to be this kind of intervention.
We'll let the other two speak to that, but my experience, it ranges from quietly listening to, frankly, rank hostility.
Okay.
I've had different responses. I've had women that just literally do not want the rose, and they do not want you in their face, and they will tell you so. But there are women that respond with looks of love in their eyes and fear in their eyes. Yeah. Some women have started to cry. Some women start weeping. And then there are women that accept the rose, and they sit there and they think about it, but they still fill out their paperwork while they're holding the rose.
Do you find that many women are ambivalent about this, that they're of two minds? Mm-hmm. Even though they're already there, there remains some discomfort that they're going to be facing this abortion?
Yes, I agree. And the thing is, they're in a crisis, and they're trying to find the easiest solution in their mind. And we have to go in with the mindset.
This is the least evil in their mind. This is the lesser evil.
Exactly. And we have to go in that mindset that we are going in as crisis intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've had women a lot. I'm a full-time Siwa counselor say, I don't want to do this, but I have to. I have no other choice.
Right.
And so we have to address the reason why they're going into the abortion facility. Take a moment, step back, let's talk. It's going to be okay. But then often when we are in the abortion facility's waiting room, we have a good conversation with the mother, but then the boyfriend or the husband will come in and intervene. And so
do you think again, you can't judge hearts, but I'm just curious, do you get the impression that most women seeking abortion feel like they have no other option?
Yes and no. I don't think I have actually penetrated that.
Yeah.
I think we have to be a little bit, and I don't want to say judging anybody because that would be quite wrong, but I think there is an element of selfishness involved. You have to penetrate through that.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want the responsibility of raising a child, and you have to penetrate through that. And so the thing that the rescuer has to do, the thing that a sidewalk counselor has to do, is arouse the conscience, to awaken the conscience that despite your not wanting to mother and to be responsible for a child, you know you can't kill. And that will supersede the selfishness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've been giving a lot of thought to this, and the likelihood of turning a woman away at this 11th hour attempt, I think we have to be fair and honest, is going to be small. Mm-hmm. And why is it going to be small? And I want to digress about this before we end this interview, because I want people to understand the merit and the need to do Red Rose Rescues, even if we don't save any babies. Right. Okay, all right.
It's an act of fidelity in bearing witness.
So
I mean,
my thought is, even on a psychological level, when the woman has walked into the clinic and she's sitting in that waiting room and she is filling out the forms, you're dealing with someone who has made a decision to abort. So to reverse that decision in that environment where she is actually in the killing place is going to be difficult.
Right.
She has set her will toward doing the abortion, accomplishing the abortion.
She's already in the door.
She's in the door.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have to deal with that in a sense set will, the determined will, I'm going to go through with it. And she's made multiple decisions, perhaps for days, maybe even weeks, that brought her in literally into the place.
Absolutely.
So you have to reverse all of that within a 10-minute time frame.
Mm-hmm.
So But why still should we remain there? Because there's the baby.
It's the act of solidarity.
And you have to be with that baby who's unwanted.
Yeah.
And if I was scheduled for execution, I wouldn't I want someone to abide with me in that final moment?
Right.
So this is an act of charity for that unwanted baby. Even should the mother hasn't listened to us, she's not going to be turning away. We'll love her to the end, but we got to stay there for her unborn child who has nobody to speak for that baby, to stand up for that baby, and to be with that baby in those final moments as long as we can stay there.
So that solidarity and staying there in solidarity with the unborn, then when they arrest you, it's essentially saying to the unborn, well, if they reject you, they're also rejecting me.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So there's got to be that parity.
Right.
Yeah. Go ahead, Patrice.
I have something to add to what Monica was talking about there, because we actually did have that type of a situation in Trenton, New Jersey. I want to mention prayer, because there's a lot of prayer packed into this. Between us, we go to confession, we go to Mass, and we have adoration before we walk in. There's a serious amount of prayer going on, and we go in as a team. But there's you know, praise God for how he works amongst us. Another rescuer, Will Goodman, and I were in the Trenton Planned Parenthood, and there was a woman there that was filling out her paperwork that Will was trying to appeal to, but she couldn't speak English. She was Spanish. And her boyfriend was sitting next to her. The boyfriend did not want the abortion, we came to find out.
Wow.
She wanted it. She continued to fill out the paperwork. We were trying to appeal to her, and Will couldn't speak the language. He was having a very difficult time, so he sat back. He gave her the rose, or he gave him the rose. The man took the rose. The woman had gone into the back room. And when she came back out, her boyfriend handed the rose to her, and she took the rose and smiled, but then continued to fill out the paperwork. So she didn't know where the rose came from. But Will was sitting there praying that somebody might have some Spanish lit, and I had gone around and placed Human Life Alliance's pamphlet with the Spanish literature, mm-hmm. and he looked over, and there it was sitting, and he picked it up and he handed it to her. And this couple got up and walked
and
out
left.
Later.
Well, that's a powerful story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lauren?
To go back on what Dr. Miller was saying, I've known about her for years, and I've read her books and watched her videos.
Yeah.
And what sold me on Red Rose Rescue was this, and it's every time I go in, every time I know I'm about to be dragged out or anything like that, this is what is always on my mind. It's not how many babies were saved, it's how many babies were loved.
Yeah.
Amen.
When she said that, when I've read that, it sold me, because we're called to love. We look at the parable of the Good Samaritan. He went into the ditch, and we go into these places, the ditch ministry.
Yeah.
And we are called to love as Jesus has called us. And so when Dr. Miller said that, it just honestly, it sealed the deal for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when I've explained Red Rose Rescue to others, the point of, it's not how many babies were saved, it's how many were loved. A lot of people have come to realize the importance of staying behind as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe before I forget, I mean, if anyone wants to talk to us about Red Rose Rescues, get more information, join us in the upcoming Red Rose Rescues, they can always send an email to citizens, okay. Citizens for a Pro-Life Society. So the website has a contact, so you can always send an email to us. And the website is prolifesociety.com, prolifesociety.com. There's no hyphen. And then you just click on the contact tab, and you can send us an email, and we will get back in touch with you. There's also on the left sidebar on the homepage an archive of articles, photographs, materials having to do with Red Rose Rescue, so people can read up on it as well.
Just got about a minute here. Is this a growing movement, would you say?
I think so, slowly.
Yeah,
slowly. And we're in the we're going to have our own dedicated website for Red Rose Rescue. Hopefully in the next couple of weeks.
Good.
I have somebody, a web designer, working on it. So.
Okay. Well, Monica, thanks once again, of course. Always good talking with you. And great making your acquaintance, Lauren. Patrice, thanks so much for your work and your identification with the unborn. We'll talk again.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Al.
Thank you.
Operation Rescue, Red Rose Rescue, what they all have in common is the willingness to intervene right in direct action and putting yourself between the child who's being brought to be executed, and you stand between the child and the abortionist instruments of destruction. Now, with Operation Rescue back in the 1980s when it was at its peak, it meant placing your bodies in front of the doors of abortion clinics, and those clinics would almost always close that day. And it was believed that women, because of their ambivalence about abortion, would often reconsider. And we actually do have on record a number of children who were born as a result of the rescue movement. But it was controversial, I should say that, even among pro-life people and certainly with Christians generally. At its peak in May of 1989 in the Detroit area, we turned out 1,000 rescuers. Three clinics were shut down. About 250 people were arrested. But the movement eventually subsided for a variety of reasons. One of them was that we no longer could have reasonable assurance that we were going to be able to save lives. And if that's the case, well, Christians have to consider whether it's proper to even violate trespass laws. You see, St. Paul puts a premium on Christians living as far as possible at peace with everyone. He says, you know, live quiet, peaceable lives so that our opponents will have no reason to criticize our exemplary behavior. He also says that we're to be in submission to the civil authorities, to the basic law of the land. So on the face of it, I think a Christian might say, wait a minute, how can you be violating the law here? Well, have to remember this. St. Paul also wrote a number of his letters from prison. Clearly, there are times when one must obey God rather than man, and we have a duty to save lives when we know they are in jeopardy and when we have reasonable assurance that we can intervene. Even our civil law has what they call the necessity defense within it. If you know a husband is beating his wife next door, you, in principle, can physically intervene, and the law would supposedly cover you against trespass laws. So most people who engage in rescue do so understanding that we are justified in breaking the law if we have reasonable assurance that we are saving lives. So, for instance, the Hebrew midwives in the book of Exodus disobeyed Pharaoh's order to kill the Hebrew children, and God rewarded them because they feared God. They violated the law of Pharaoh, but they saved lives. I'm Al Cresta.
How would you define the word beatitude? Webster's Dictionary defines beatitude as a state of utmost bliss and a declaration made in the Sermon on the Mount. The Catechism of the Catholic Church states that the Beatitudes are, in effect, a portrait of the man who declared them, Jesus Christ, depicting his countenance and portraying his charity. The Beatitudes also describe the attitudes and actions that should portray and depict his followers, true Christians. The Beatitudes are paradoxical in their promises. None seems more paradoxical than number 8, which proclaims, "Blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven." The paradox is that God is present even amidst trials and tribulations. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
What is criticism exactly? If you pay close attention, do you notice what most criticism is? Oh, it's not because you're doing something wrong. or hurtful, something that needs corrected, most criticism is, you're not doing it the way I would do it. Or you're not doing it the way I want you to do it. That's what most criticism is. And you have to get good at sorting that out. Otherwise, you're going to get real upset when anyone says anything about what you are doing. Now, of course, you could turn this on yourself. Do you do that? Is most of your criticism a message to someone else that says, you're not doing it the way I would do it? Well, save your criticism for things that are really wrong.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Thank you for being with me this hour. We'll have posted in the Cresta Guest Archives follow-up information on the Red Rose Rescue. Just head on over to AveMariaRadio.net. AveMariaRadio.net. Now, next hour, we continue our look at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Plenary Assembly, their Spring Assembly in Baltimore. They voted today to approve proposals intended to respond to recent scandals involving sexual abuse, coercion, and cover-up on the part of bishops, most notably, of course, the McCarrick incident, and now the disgraced Bishop Michael Bransfield. Again, these were votes were made in overwhelming numbers. I mean, I think four people voted against one of them, two or three voted against the others. The consensus among the bishops is great, and let's see how this ends up working out in practice. Ed Condon, editor at Catholic News Agency, himself a canon lawyer, will be joining us to talk about exactly what the bishops achieved today. I'll also cycle back a bit on the conversation and commentary about Jonathan Morris leaving the priesthood. There was a good response on the Facebook page, a lot of comments, and some that I thought I wanted to respond to. So that's coming up in this hour. Also, Dr. Greg Popcheck on lay spirituality and family spirituality. Stay with me.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. Well, thanks for joining me this hour. As promised, we'll go to Baltimore and talk with Ed Condon, who's been covering the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Spring Assembly there. They voted earlier today to approve proposals intended to respond to recent scandals, which, of course, we all know about, involving sexual abuse, coercion, and cover-up. And I understand that the votes were decided by overwhelming margins. There were almost no people opposed to the measures as they were stated. I was going to ask Ed about that. It's unusual. I think it's unusual to see that kind of overwhelming support for any directive. That's coming up. Also, thank you so much, all of you who responded on Facebook to the interview that, not the interview, excuse me, the commentary on the interview that Marsha McCallum did with the former Catholic priest Jonathan Morris. There are a few things there that were said that I thought worth commenting on. Again, overwhelmingly positive response on the Facebook page. But I did want to bring up a few things that were said that I thought need to be clarified a bit. Also coming up in this hour, we're going to spend time with Dr. Gregory Popcheck talking about the question of family love and why the domestic church is the future of the parish church. You cannot have a strong parish if you don't have strong families. Strong families are there to help create an environment, a school of discipleship, to help find those who will follow Jesus, bear witness to his kingdom, and ultimately spend eternity face-to-face with God in heaven. So we're going to talk with Greg about this question of lay spirituality, family spirituality, and the domestic church. But first, the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, June 13th. It's the Feast of St. Anthony of Padua. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is approving a third-party system to report allegations of sexual abuse or misconduct. Baltimore's Auxiliary Bishop Adam J. Parker says laypeople and secular authorities will be part of the reporting system. Under the nationwide system, those with complaints would be able to report them confidentially over the phone or online. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is blaming Iran for attacks on tankers at the Gulf of Oman.
This is only the latest in a series of attacks instigated by the Islamic Republic of Iran and its surrogates against American and allied interests.
Speaking at the State Department today, Pompeo said Iran's actions are a clear threat to international peace and security. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says no one issue will trigger impeachment proceedings against President Trump.
As we go down this path to seek the truth for the American people and to hold the president accountable, it has nothing to do with politics.
She again accused the president of engaging in a criminal cover-up. Pelosi referred to Trump's controversial remark that he would probably listen to a foreign source if they offered him dirt on a political opponent. Meanwhile, White House Deputy Press Secretary Hogan Gidley says that during the 2016 race, the DNC and the Clinton campaign paid Foreign National Christopher Steele to dig up dirt on Trump.
They're the ones who solicited and paid for information from a foreign entity in Christopher Steele, who got fake information from Russia, and they use it to weaponize an entire campaign against this president, first as a candidate and now as the president of the United States.
The St. Louis Blues are celebrating their first Stanley Cup championship. They beat the Bruins 4-1 in Game 7 in Boston. The Toronto Raptors can win their first NBA championship with a win over the shorthanded Golden State Warriors tonight in Oakland. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Today is day 3 of the Plenary Assembly of the United States Council of Catholic Bishops. They are meeting and voting. Today is the meat and potatoes day. Joining me right now is canon lawyer and editor of Catholic News Agency, Ed Condon, in Baltimore. Ed, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me what happened.
Well, so this morning the bishops finally got together and were presented with the final drafts of the three big documents that are aimed fairly directly at addressing the crisis of credibility they've been facing over the last year. There was a lot less debate than I think a lot of people were expecting. The bishops originally budgeted the whole morning for, you know, discussion of possible amendments and even just sort of interventions from the floor. And in the end, they ended up finishing almost 2 hours ahead of schedule.
Wow.
Most of the things passed through with overwhelming majorities. I think of the three, one had 4 votes against and the other two had 2 or 1 against.
Wow.
And I don't think that was a surprise. I think a lot of people expected it to go through, but the lack of conversation, I think, took a lot of people by surprise.
Well, tell me exactly what those measures were aimed at.
Well, so there were three. One was what they called an affirmation of our episcopal commitments. And this was really a step at providing a moral commitment by the bishops to hold themselves really to the same standards that priests have been held to ever since the Dallas Charter of 2002. At the same time, they were recognizing in this document what they called the righteous anger of the laity and saying, you know, there's been a loss of trust here and it's justified and that we need to really rededicate ourselves to winning it back. Side by side with that was a more procedural technical document aimed at bringing the Pope's reforms that he published last month and came into force at the beginning of this month, adapting them sort of for the life of the church in the United States, talking about sort of the where and how of the Pope's new laws on reporting sexual abuse against bishops would come into force, and that also passed with an overwhelming majority. And the third document was something a little different. What they were looking to do there really was talk about setting up an independent reporting mechanism which would allow people anywhere in the country to make a complaint against a bishop, which would then be filtered out to the relevant metropolitan archbishop.
So those are three, significant documents. But the first one strikes me as kind of not very controversial at all. Applying the Pope's recommendations here, I would have thought, would have gotten a lot of debate. And this independent reporting mechanism, I think most of us thought something, they were going to have to do something like that. But is there more to say about the absence of debate on this?
Well, I think you can read it one of two ways. There's the encouraging way, which is to say that, there was just really an overwhelming consensus on what needed to be done here, and they did it. And I think that's not an unfair characterization of a lot of what was going on. There wasn't no debate. A lot of bishops raised, again, they talked a little bit about this on Tuesday when they first raised these documents, about really enshrining a clear and obligatory role for the laity in this process. And that was raised again. But I think another thing that was perhaps lacking, and maybe people were expecting, and that's why they budgeted so much time for this, was rather like when the bishops met in Baltimore in November last year, there was a lot of personal reflection on how the scandal had impacted individual bishops in their diocese and their own reflections on that. And we didn't see that this time.
Hmm. I wonder why. I mean, do you have any speculation on why? Are they kind of run out of gas on that?
I don't know if they've run out of gas. I think that a lot of them are perhaps a little wary, and they don't want to be the person who appears to be hectoring their brother bishops, which, in a sense, I think is a little bit of a missed opportunity. Not that, anyone wants to see the bishops taking to the floor to, knock chunks out of each other or anything like that. But I think a lot of the laity have heard a lot from their bishops about the need for better lay accountability and transparency and things like that. And what they were looking to see were their bishops sharing their outrage. I think a missed opportunity so far at Baltimore has been no one really took the opportunity to put themselves on the side of the laity, that they were speaking very much as the bishops to the laity. And I think that was a missed opportunity.
No, that makes sense to me. I don't know why they wouldn't have taken the opportunity to do that, even reading from letters that they may have received from laity that they thought were representative of the engaged laity's attitude at this time. When we talk about lay involvement, again, there's always this goodwill that's expressed for it, but the mechanism for it that is difficult. Is there anything in these three documents that actually specify any new mechanism for lay participation?
Yeah, there was a really clear articulation of the directives for implementing Bos Estes, saying that when an accusation is made against a bishop, it goes to the competent metropolitan archbishop, but at the same time it's going to go to a designated lay person who's going to help in the investigation and later on in the assessment of these things. Now, a lot of the debate centered on the fact that they didn't say it had to, that they only said that it should, and I think a lot of bishops wanted to see this language toughened up. But what they came up against was really the conference doesn't have the authority to take away the latitude that the Pope has given.
He's already given them that kind of liberty to implement this the way they think they should in their own diocese. And the USCCB cannot set that aside.
Exactly. And I one thing Cardinal Tobin said at one point was that even in a meeting with all of the metropolitan bishops, which took place behind closed doors earlier, was that no one was under any illusions that this was not an optional extra, that even though Bos Estes is not vague, but broad, because it's a global document that needs to take into account circumstances everywhere in the world about how this could be done. There was absolute consensus amongst the American bishops about, well, we're going to do it in this particular way.
Yeah. Okay. So that's good. Were there any bishops, by their oratory or engagement, stood above the others, especially pertinent comments or analyses?
I don't think so. And I think that was really the vacuum at the middle of the debate, or, you know, the lack of debate, was I think a lot of people were looking for a moral leader to emerge. And I don't think we really saw one. We saw a very small minority of bishops, given the numbers in the room, really take to the microphone at all. I think I'd estimated it probably 20 bishops or fewer really got up and talked at all over the course of the 3 days. And I think a lot of people in the room and outside were looking for someone to step up and be a sort of prophetic voice in the
right.
middle of all of this, and we just didn't see it.
That's interesting. That's something to keep in mind. The piece that you wrote for Catholic News Agency, you were mentioning Bishop Robert Dealey explaining to the conference that the independent third-party reporting mechanism approved by the bishops yesterday was itself a form of self-auditing system, with every complaint being tracked, though there were limits to how much the bishops could assess the effectiveness of what was a papal law. How did that go over? How did Dealey's presentation go over with the other bishops?
Well, a lot of questions were asked about Bishop Dealey across all of the documents, really, because as head of the Church Governance and Canonical Affairs Committee, it fell to him to present these things to the whole conference. And there's a lot of expectation among bishops. They want to know that these processes are working now that they're going to the trouble of building them and putting them in place. And while it's easy enough to say, because we're involving, you know, an entire third-party national mechanism for receiving these allegations, we can track to make sure they get to the right metropolitan archbishop and the right layperson who's going to be assisting him in receiving these things, that's all very easy to keep an eye on. But when other bishops were calling for a sort of complete audit of the whole process and how is this handled, it gets a bit thorny for the U.S. bishops in terms of their authority, because, of course, a key part of all of this is immediately this stuff has to go to Rome. It has to go to the Holy See. And it's not really for the American bishops, much less any independent body they want to commission to evaluate how effectively the Holy See is putting in place its own laws, especially when, you know, these things have only come in for a 3-year experimental period, and the Holy See said they're going to be evaluating them along the way too.
Yeah, okay. Did McCarrick's name come up, or Bransfield's name, or Mahoney's name come up as disgraced, former ordinaries?
There was very little talk of individual cases like that. At one point, I think it was Bishop Dealey made reference to the fact that the metropolitan model that they were enshrining with these norms had already been used 4 times in the last year. And he didn't name the names of the bishops who were subject to that, but, you know, 2 of them we know right away were McCarrick and Bransfield. There's also been an auxiliary bishop of New York who's been under a Vatican investigation. And he said that, you know, we've seen these things beginning to work. We've seen that they can get the job done, and that should give us confidence. But really, this sort of naming names of McCarrick and Michael Bransfield, that was the dog that really didn't bark at this conference.
Is that just a matter? I mean, there's something about the ecclesial culture that I don't personally quite understand, and that is, it seems to me, the unwillingness to acknowledge what, at least on the part of lay people, seems obvious. These guys acted in a villainous way. Why don't you make it clear that you feel the same way as we do about this?
I think that's a really excellent question, and I think it's one shared by a lot of the journalists who are here covering it, and I think a lot of the lay people who are watching it on the live stream. It would seem, I think, to a lot of people to be an open goal for a bishop to stand up and say, I recognize nothing of my own ministry, nothing of my own time as a bishop in what's been reported about, you know, Theodore McCarrick or Michael Bransfield. You know, this is alien to me, and I'm outraged by it. And I really did find it surprising that more weren't willing to do that.
See, this is my own opinion as I'm trying to understand this whole thing. There's something built in to that ecclesial culture that discourages that kind of standing apart and offering a prophetic word. I don't know if it's a feeling that that's uncooperative, or it somehow is rocking the boat, or one is claiming certain self-righteousness. But I think it really separates the ecclesial culture that the bishops operate in from the normal day-to-day life that engaged Catholics are living within, and the way they talk with one another. Seems like two different worlds to me.
I think that's true. I was talking to one bishop and said, and I asked him this directly, and I said, you know, why didn't you, for example, stand up and say these sorts of things? And his response to me was interesting, which he said, well, many of us in different parts of the country have got either a grand jury or a state's attorney investigation ongoing, and we're not really 100% sure what we can say about these things. You know, if you're a bishop of a diocese that was once led by Theodore McCarrick, you might be a little wary of standing up in front of a microphone and saying something out loud that, you know, you don't know if it's sub judice, you don't know if it's something that the state's attorney's going to later ask you to repeat 20 times.
That's a good point. Ed, thanks so much. We'll stay in touch.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Ed Condon, you can follow him on Twitter at Canon Lawyered. At Canon Lawyered. I'm Al Cresta.
We recently won an important case in federal court in Toledo, Ohio. For too long, city police officers were enforcing local and state laws to prohibit pro-lifers from engaging in free speech activity on the public sidewalks outside of a local abortion center. In our case, the court issued an order prohibiting the city and its police officers from enforcing any local or state law as applied to the expressive activity of pro-life demonstrators, including our clients. This is yet another victory for the First Amendment in a case where a city and its police officers were abusing their authority to silence peaceful pro-life demonstrators to appease those engaged in the baby-killing business. As the court's order demonstrates, the Constitution protects our clients' pro-life activity from such abuse. The government has no authority to silence our clients' speech simply because they are preaching the gospel on a public sidewalk next to an abortion center. Indeed, this victory is yet another blow to the abortion industry, which has too often relied on the government to promote and support its bloody business by silencing those who oppose it. The actions of the city of Toledo and its officers in this case were deplorable, and they violated our clients' fundamental rights. We stop this egregious activity in Toledo, and we intend to stop it wherever it raises its ugly head. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
Now, on the Ave Maria Radio app, the prayer section, where you can listen to the Holy Rosary. All four mysteries are voiced by Christ as the Answer and Father Knows Best host, Father John Ricardo. Are you struggling to remember specific prayers for pre- and post-confession, reciting the Stations of the Cross, or prayers during Eucharistic Adoration? It's all there, word for word, and within a few clicks under the prayer section on the Ave Maria Radio app. Download it on your smart device today.
Beth, why is our health insurance so expensive? Our premium and deductible are so high. Plus, I don't want my family to support a company that doesn't share our values.
Kim, there is another option. Check out CMF Curo. It's an affordable Catholic healthcare ministry where members share their medical costs in community, and it's pro-life. We joined last year and have saved thousands, all without compromising our values. Just go to MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
CMF Curo sounds exactly like what our family needs.
Yeah, that's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Join me, Teresa Tomeo, and Father John Ricardo for fun fellowship and beautiful weather during our Good News Marriage Cruise. Former NFL star Matt Burke will also be there sailing the Caribbean as we explore how to rejuvenate your marriage in Christ. We're sailing January 26th to February 1st, so call 855-879-6932. That's 855-879-6932. Or visit AveMariaRadio.net for early registration discounts.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
It's practically an epidemic. 20% of Americans suffer from anxiety disorders, and millions more wrestle with worry and stress on a daily basis. For us as Christians, all that worry gets mixed up with a lot of guilt. How can we stop worrying and start living an anxiety-free life? I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, and in my new book, Unworried, A Life Without Anxiety, you'll learn how to respect how God made us and build new habits of thinking, communicating, and acting that will help set you free from worry. You can get your copy of Unworried and any of my other books at AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta, and thank you. By the way, all of you who responded on Facebook to my commentary on Jonathan Morris's interview on Martha McCallum's program, I think it was Tuesday night, there were a number of comments there that were less than sympathetic with Morris's leaving the priesthood. And, you know, they tossed out the comments like, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, once a priest, always a priest. I took a different tack on this. Of course, like most Catholics, I don't rejoice in anyone leaving the priesthood. But I do think that we should try to be as generous as the Church is generous when it comes to disciplinary matters. Now, I'm no expert on all of the canonical issues that go in on, dispensing a man from his vows or laicization or having his faculties revoked. The Church has a number of different stances, all distinguished from one another by subtleties that, in truth, most of us don't ever really consider, since most of us are not entering into holy orders. So in dealing with this situation with Jonathan Morris, I start from the things I know, and I know what it's like to not want to let people down, and despairing of ever being able to describe satisfactorily why I think it's right to sometimes have to let them down. Rest assured, Mr. Morris consulted with Cardinal Dolan and many others over a period of many years, and as it turns out, he now sees that he was the product, that his, quote, priesthood was the product of a systematic system of abuse. That's what the Legion of Christ was doing during the years that Jonathan Morris was being groomed. The Legion of Christ under Marcial Maciel was a spiritually abusive institution for which they have been criticized by secular and Catholic authorities. Jonathan was a product of that group, and I think we have to take, I think we take him at his word on this. Who are we to judge him anyways? In all honesty, really, this is his call. It's not your call. It's not my call. I did think the interview did more harm than good. I think I said that the other day. Only God knows for certain, of course, but I thought the interview tended to undermine the moral and spiritual authority of holy orders, not because he's leaving the priesthood, but because most viewers won't have a clue what's involved in becoming a priest. I think most viewers are going to think that being a priest is basically about, well, you don't get married, and you do ritual actions like this mass, and you probably have to be something of a people person because you probably have to go visit hospitals and, you know, do marriage counseling and stuff like that. There's almost no understanding, even among Catholics, of the Church's rich understanding of the Sacrament of Holy Orders. So I thought, you know, the net effect of airing this problem publicly was to weaken or to confuse the image of the priest. But again, I don't know that. That's the way it comes across to me. For those who are rendering harsh judgments on Mr. Morris because he left the priesthood, think about marriage. Would you feel bad about a man or woman leaving a marriage in which he or she made their vows under duress? You remember the old notion of the shotgun wedding? You know, the guy gets a woman pregnant, the woman's father grabs a shotgun and forces the guy to marry her. You know, nobody thinks that's an authentic, valid marriage. You say that marriage was invalid because of psychological duress. In many ways, Morris was forced into the Catholic priesthood by a torrent of external social forces that played on his wish to please and to do God's will. And he's not alone. You should read the testimony of so many men who have left the Legion of Christ. I've known at least a half dozen of them, and the stories are so, so discouraging. During the period of time when Morris was being formed, as a priest, the Legion of Christ was exhibiting ungodly pressure on its candidates. They laid on the guilt. They surrounded you with contacts and acquaintances that were, quote, within the movement. They practice love bombing, immediately making you feel especially gifted and wonderful, and God has called you, putting the... I mean, in a number of cases, I've heard people tell me that their leaders, their superiors, the people they answered to, arrogated to themselves the voice of God. I consulted the Holy Spirit, and he told me to tell you, that kind of thing. When you somebody does that to you, it's time to walk. For young men of high school and college age, though, this can be very appealing, especially if there's a problem in the relationship with the father. These become surrogate father figures who you submit to. In my first 10 years as a Christian, I spent a lot of time evangelizing young men and women who were in aberrant forms of Christianity, what we call cults. The Unification Church of Sun Myung Moon, the Children of God of Moses David Berg, the Way International of Victor Paul Weirwill, and many others. These were organizations that practiced spiritual abuse and coercion. They applied such psychological pressure that the young men and women who entered into these groups for any length of time, for years, often these men and women would feel ambivalent about leaving the group. And I know in more than one case, people return to these abusive groups because at least there they were having somebody who effectively cared for them. Even if there were put downs, at least they were saying good things about me too. I wasn't getting that out in the world. Some people who didn't especially like Jonathan Morris's style on Fox, I think, expected me to comment on his manner of presentation. I should probably point out that I have a rule of thumb in which I generally don't bother criticizing other apostolates or other Catholics who are in ministry unless they're openly heretical, living in immorality, or in open rebellion to the Holy See. I don't say I think so-and-so comes across this way. Now, on some occasions, the person's manner of presentation, their style, does create great confusion. And I happen to think right now in Pope Francis, because he has a certain type of style and manner of presentation, and I think it's created tremendous confusion. I think he relies a lot on ambiguity. He doesn't finish. He begins to lead a conversation in one direction and doesn't bring it through to its conclusion. I think that's causing great spiritual harm with many people. I'm not saying he's a heretic. I'm not saying that I know the faith better than he knows the faith. That's not what I'm trying to say. But I'm a fairly, observant person, and I talk to many people who are responding to this pontificate. And I know many people who feel themselves less confident about the future of Catholicism because of his leadership. So I don't mind saying something at a person's manner of presentation if, in fact, there's something at stake. But generally speaking, no, I don't. I'm not going to tell you that I think so-and-so is smarmy or such-and-such is kind of a wispy romantic figure. No, but who cares? Generally, if a man or woman is not teaching heresy, engaging in immorality, or being grossly insubordinate, I don't bother offering an opinion. God uses all kinds. Look, St. Paul, he's writing to the Philippians, and he's been undergoing a lot of criticism. He's been getting put downs from people who are false apostles, and he's having to defend himself regularly. I mean, 2 Corinthians, for instance, is almost entirely a defense of his apostleship. The first four chapters of 1 Corinthians, he's defending his apostleship. So he writes to the Philippians, and he finally says, look, I don't care. Some preach Christ out of selfish motives. Other preach Christ because they want a reputation. Other preach Christ because they want personal gain. So what? What do I care as long as Christ is being preached? I try to take that as my guiding light when it comes to dealing with other ministries, apostolates, people's style. Yeah, there's some people I like better than others, but it's a matter of personal taste. And it's not up to me to interfere with their apostolate by making, unnecessary comments about matters which are not directly related to content of teaching. stout morality or obedience to the Holy See. So, but thanks again. It was fun reading over the comments. Again, a lot of good comments there and helpful. Thank you. Oh, and by the way, do go to the AveMariaRadio.net and get involved so you get the, you know, get our Facebook presentations and sign up on Twitter too, because we do send out material letting you know what's coming up on the program. It's funny, there's so much contradiction in our society today. There is really, we've lost a center, you know, kind of a common morality that we all share, or a common set of values. And you find all kinds of contradictory comments being made. So back in March, Senator Kamala Harris said that it's ridiculous and outrageous for Vice President Mike Pence to limit his one-on-one time with women. You know, this is, I think Pence is a smart man to do this, especially in this day and age. And he says, she said, I disagree with him when he suggests it's not possible to have meetings with women alone by himself. I think that's ridiculous. The idea that you would deny a professional woman the opportunity to have a meeting with the Vice President of the United States is outrageous. Now, Harris was referring to a statement that Pence said back in 2002, that he never eats alone with a woman other than his wife, and that he won't attend events featuring alcohol without her by his side. You know, this is just prudential judgments that he owes. You think that's too strict? Fine. But this is the way he's decided to live his life. But what's funny is now Keanu Reeves is getting praised, because when he is being photographed with women, he won't touch them, you know? I mean, you can't have it both ways here. There's a tweet showing Reeves posing with multiple women, including Dolly Parton, with his arm behind the woman and his hand hovering over either their arms or waists, because he's not going to touch them. And now all of a sudden, he's a darling for showing this kind of respect to women. When a society begins to invent its own morality, it is confused. We have a society that has, for the most part, abandoned the sixth commandment. It's no longer being regarded as common moral value in our culture. So by setting aside the law of God, you create a vacuum, and you have to then invent something to replace it. We're in that crazy period of trying to replace the sixth commandment. How are men supposed to treat women? How are husbands supposed to treat women who are not their wives? It's all in flux. I'm Al Cresta.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 10 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan cost goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Abortion.
Pornography.
Embryonic stem cell research.
Corporate contributions to Planned Parenthood. Do you invest in companies that are engaged in these practices? The Ave Maria Mutual Funds do not, and their investment portfolios reflect that. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. You can learn more about the Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses.
Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
Your worldview governs most everything else about your moral choices, your assumptions, and attitudes. It's the main premise behind your belief system. Worldview is the ethical air you breathe, or if you are a fish, the water you swim in. Think of how different the atheistic worldview is from the theistic one. If you believe there's no God and you're just electric meat with an extra bit of charm, there's no special plan for your life, and certainly no life after death, that's going to affect your daily decisions right down to your attitude to the alarm clock in the morning. If you're a Christian, then you're going to see everything in a very different way. Most people cobble together their worldview from the news, their friends, pop culture, maybe their school textbooks. What's your worldview? Can you sum it up in one sentence? Because it determines everything else. This is Patrick Coffin of PatrickCoffin.media. Be a saint. What else is there?
What will eternal happiness, beatitude, be like? St. Augustine has a pleasant description. There we shall rest and see, we shall see and love, we shall love and praise, what will be at the end without end. For what other end do we have, if not to reach the kingdom which has no end? The Catechism tells us, God put us in the world to know, to love, and to serve Him, and be with Him forever in heaven. The Beatitudes present us with clear moral choices. We are invited to avoid evil, to purify our hearts of evil, and to love God above all earthly things, none of which can bring lasting happiness. Lasting happiness can be found only in God, who is the source of every good and all love. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. With me is Dr. Gregory Popcheck. You know Greg from his daily program, of course, More to Life, where he and his wife Lisa answer questions on a wide range of issues dealing with family, marriage, mental health, and well-being. I want to spend today, though, talking about what makes family life holy, exactly, because we've heard a lot about the domestic church, we've heard a lot about the universal call to holiness, lay spirituality. Most of us, of course, have to live out our spirituality in families. So what is it about family life that is holy, and how can we really look at the domestic church as something more than just a metaphor? Greg, good to have you here.
It's great to be here, Al. Thank you.
Let's talk about this idea. I see that Pope Francis has already chose a theme for the World Meeting of Families in 2021. And so family love, a vocation, and a path to holiness. So, I mean, that's a theme right up your alley.
Yeah, the idea that the family love is a vocation and path to holiness. That's a beautiful idea. But I think for most people, it's a lovely sentiment.
Yeah.
But I don't know that we really relate to it in a very concrete way. The idea that family life is holy. I think that, you know, when most of us think of our families, and compare them, say, to the Holy Family, we don't think so much Holy Family as we think, holy cow, you know, what am I supposed to do with this, right? But the reality is our family life is holy, and not just for the time we spend in prayer or the time we spend serving others, but the very fact of family life is holy itself. There's a wonderful quote I came across while I was preparing, well, Lisa and I were preparing our presentation for the Symposium on Catholic Family Life and Spirituality that we're hosting at Notre Dame this summer.
This July, right?
That's right, yeah. And I just wanted to share this quote. It's by a theologian, Philip Monolakis is his name. And he says, "It is not the imposition of religious rituals on the family that makes it sacred, but the presence of Christ, the presence of the Holy Spirit in each member, and each person's response to Christ in each interaction that makes the family holy. The religious rituals serve to support those interactions within family life. Families are not church only when they read scriptures, pray, study the faith, or help the needy. They are church in their turning toward love, and it is Christ's love that constitutes the church of the home.
Yeah.
I thought that's just so beautiful and powerful. But we have a tendency to think that, you know, oh, you know, saying that family life is holy, you know, we're just trying to get credit for stuff we have to do anyway. But, you know, that's the thing. It's like God wants to use the mundane stuff we have to do anyway to make us holy. That's the whole point of having a sacramental worldview. God takes common stuff and uses it to facilitate our holiness. It doesn't get any more basic than bread and wine or water.
Right.
But he uses those things to create miracles, and he wants to use the changing the diapers and the paying the bills and the washing the dishes and the getting the kid a drink at 3 o'clock in the morning and everything else to make you holy and to draw you closer to each other and to him. And I think we miss out on a lot of those things as families.
At your family symposium coming up at Notre Dame in July, you and Lisa will be talking on the liturgical nature of the domestic church. And so, you know, we're familiar with the liturgy of the Eucharist. What would be the liturgy of domestic church?
Well, and this is something that actually needs to be developed. And so this is sort of a kind of a thought experiment. You know, if we could think of family life in liturgical terms, you know, first of all, is that appropriate? And it is. There's a lot of actually good theology to kind of support that idea. But you know, let's kind of look at this in a sense. So if something's liturgical, the church tells us that it has to be instituted, not invented. So in other words, we can't just create something and call it a liturgy. It has to be given to us by God. And family life certainly was. You know, at the very beginning of time, God gives Adam and Eve to each other and says, go forth and multiply. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, thousands of years later, Christ again uses the wedding feast at Cana as the first occasion of as the occasion of his first miracle and raises that to the dignity of a sacrament. So this idea that a family is a man and a woman and their children is a revealed instituted concept, not just a social contract that, that we've come up with. Mm-hmm. So that meets that liturgical box, right? Another example of what liturgy does is it conveys God's blessing and love, and certainly family life does that. It puts a face on God's love. Families are called by the church schools of love and icons of the Trinity. You know, so when children look at their parents, they should be able to see God loving them through their parents. And so, again, the church affirms that there's that liturgical dimension of conveying God's love and blessing to people. Another dimension of liturgy is that liturgy facilitates transformation and healing and integration. You know, that when we participate in liturgy, we draw closer to God. And so God brings the broken pieces of ourselves together. Well, so does family life. You know, as we draw closer to God through the interactions in our family and learn to love and serve each other more generously, we draw the broken pieces of ourselves and each other together. And then finally, the idea that liturgy calls us up into the life of the Trinity. And family life does that too. Again, the family is an icon of the Trinity and allows us to really understand how Father, Son, and Holy Spirit relate to each other, especially in a Christian household that's really trying to live out that Christian love in their home. So, you know, because of those points, we argue that family life is liturgical. And then we kind of break it down from there to talk about the quote-unquote different rites that make up the liturgy of domestic church life.
Yeah, what are those rites?
Well, we talk about the rite of relationship, the rite of rituals, and the rite of reaching out. So the three R's of the liturgy of domestic church life. The rite of relationship actually forms a person in the common priesthood of our baptism. You know, Bishop Barron had a wonderful quote. He said that the common priesthood is about sacrificial love, and that through that sacrificial love we facilitate integration and union with God. And that's what the common priesthood is really all about. Well, I couldn't think of a better understanding of what that would look like in practice, except in family life, where families work together to facilitate integration and healthy formation of the whole person through that kind of sacrificial love. And so through that rite of living out relationship, of asking ourselves, not just how can we love each other on our own power, but what would it really mean to love each other with the love that flows from the heart of God? That is that rite of relationship, being intentional about the intimate communion in our home and drawing closer to each other and God through that. The second rite, the rite of rituals of connection, that's training in the prophetic mission of our baptism. Because if you think about it, every human activity fits under the categories of working, talking, praying, and playing together. You know, those four categories kind of cover everything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we have strong family rituals around working together, talking together, praying together, and playing together, what we're doing is we're mentoring our children, and our children are helping us to deepen our sense of how a Christian relates to those four spheres of activity. You know, and we're witnessing through that prophetic action, what is the Christian relationship to work and to talk and to praying and to playing? And how do we live that Christian difference in all that we do?
Right.
And so we're proclaiming to the world that Christian difference through that prophetic mission of the rite of ritual. And then the third rite of reaching out is training in the royal mission of our baptism, where we use our gifts and talents to be a blessing to others, to serve others. And so how the family, first of all, serves each other, and then takes that service on the road, even in simple ways like being polite to strangers or the server in the restaurant, you being unafraid to say grace publicly, you know, to get along with each other and smile at each other, you know, witnesses that the family life and this kind of love is possible. And then going beyond that to live your family life in ways that keeps others in mind, for example, by making an extra meal for somebody who's in need, or working as a family together to gather up those gently used clothes and toys and take them to the homeless shelter, or other family service projects at the parish or community where you're working together as a family to do good. Those are all different ways that we can practice that rite of reaching out by taking our gifts and sharing them with the community at large. And by exercising those three rites in the liturgy of domestic church life, we're practicing in a powerful way that path of holiness that leads us to sainthood, that draws us closer to God and draws us closer to each other. It's a powerful thing when families witness to that.
I know a fellow who is now a permanent deacon in the Catholic Church who was invited to just join with a parish when they were doing some service projects. He was a Protestant. And just in working with these Catholics, he eventually got interested in the fullness of the faith and eventually was received into full communion. But it occurs to me that while churches have lots of those projects, are they designed for families?
No.
Yeah, that's
and
what
that's, that's a, well, and I think that that's a big problem. We have a very individualistic focus on pastoral ministry in
right,
the church. You
right.
know, we kind of we separate groups. We say, okay, we're going to have the youth group, and we're going to have the men's group, we're going to have the women's group, we're going to have this group, and it tends to actually divide families instead of bringing families together. And I realize, you know, that sometimes single people or divorced people, you know, will say, oh, the church is all about families, and I don't feel like I
can do that. That's true. Yeah,
and I get that. All right, but there is a way to do family ministry that is inclusive, because when you think about it, even divorce ministry is about family ministry. It's about grieving the loss of one family and discerning what is God's plan for my family in the future. Even youth ministry is about family ministry, because it's how can I make a positive contribution to the family that I'm in and prepare to have a family in the future.
Yeah.
You know, all of these different ministries, I think really we need to have less programs in the church and more family stuff in the church, because God already gave us a program for formation. It's the family. And when we discover the liturgy of domestic church life, we can get rid of all those other programs that burn up our time and our budgets and our resources, and focus on forming families to do what God intended them to do in the first place.
You know, that's interesting, because of course the family does call you out from yourself to give, just by virtue of marriage, the vows that one makes, the love that one cultivates towards his or her spouse, and then certainly towards the children. So in a sense, the very fact of being in a family, there's a certain natural pressure to give. And it is funny that when it comes to church ministry, we extract the individual from the family in order to learn these things, to learn to make that general love a sacrificial love.
Yeah, and
we don't use the family.
Not at all.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Well, and in fact, you know, Cardinal Ouellette, in his book Divine Likeness, the Trinitarian Anthropology of the Family, he makes the point that historically family ministry has always been about kind of seeing the family as sort of the terminal point of ministry. In other words, you know, we're going to use ministry to fix that broken family. But what he argues, and I think that we need to see more of, is that family ministry needs to be about empowering families to be the quote-unquote program that of evangelization and formation and catechesis and all the rest of it that we currently rely on programs to do instead of the family.
Yeah.
So we need to shift up our emphasis and stop doing this sort of individualized, customized, you know, curated ministry experience, and just work with the program that God gave us and teach families how to be dynamic domestic churches.
Well, I'll tell you, you've got a radical book there, man. You take care of it. This is a book for you to write.
Amen. Thank you, Al.
We'll talk again, Greg.
God bless.
Dr. Gregory Popcheck, again, you can learn more at CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Al Cresta.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John 14. This is Jesus in the upper room with the disciples before he's going out to his sacrifice of himself for our salvation. And Philip says to the Lord, "Show us the Father, and we'll be satisfied." Jesus looks at Philip and says, "Philip, have I been with you all this time? Don't you understand? When you see me, you're looking at the Father." In fact, only two people throughout human history have given rise to the question, not who is he, but what is he? The two people are Buddha and Jesus. Buddha's answer was, "Don't come to me, don't look to me, look to my doctrine, look to what I teach." Jesus' answer was, "Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble of heart." Jesus is explicitly claiming to be God.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
If I disciplined consistently, I'd be disciplining constantly. If I were consistent in my discipline, that would mean I would discipline more, and I'd be disciplining him often. The exact opposite is the case. More consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. Why? Because you're predictable. The child knows if he does A, you'll do B. That is why, when you are predictable in your authority, you will actually have to use that authority less. Consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. The more you act when you need to act, the less you will have to act in the future with similar misbehavior.
Thank you much. Good being with you. And I do look forward to being with you tomorrow for another edition of Cresta in the Afternoon. I do want to remind you, though, that any comments we made on today's program, usually you're going to be able to find follow-up material in the Cresta guest archive. So conversation with Dr. Monica Miller and the two women who were arrested in Flint during the Red Rose Rescue will have further follow-up information on the work of the Red Rose Rescue and following the arrest follow-up with Patrice Woodworth and Lauren Handy. So head on over to AveMariaRadio.net. Go to the Cresta Guest Archives, where you'll also find further information on the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops' ongoing meeting in Baltimore. Ed Condon's reports will be posted there as well. You can also learn more of what we're doing by signing up for Facebook, because that allows you to know day-to-day what we're doing on the program so you can share it with others. We had a good response on Facebook to my commentary on Jonathan Morris. I want to urge you to head on over there and continue to make comments. And then we'll have follow-up information with Dr. Gregory Popcheck and what he's doing. You know, Pope Francis has been focusing in on the family. So the 2021 World Meeting of Families has already been established, and we're going to see Greg Popcheck will be participating in that. But this summer, he has a special seminar at the University of Notre Dame looking at this question of family spirituality. Believe it or not, in the history of Catholicism, it's an underexplored area. And it's our generation which is finally taking and embracing this concept of the domestic church. It is the overflow of what the Second Vatican Council focused on when it called for the universal call to holiness. All laity are to remember they are called to be saints. Thanks for being with me. I'm Al Cresta.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.